Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, July 18th. From Richard Wolff, USA Today. Quote, three tax increases proposed by President Obama and House Democrats on the richest Americans could produce the highest tax rates in a quarter century. The latest is this week's proposal by House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Charles Rangel, Democrat, New York, and others to impose a surtax of up to 5.4% on annual incomes of $350,000 or more to help pay for overhauling the healthcare system. About 500,000 taxpayers earning $1 million or more would pay the full surtax. Obama's budget, released in February, calls for letting tax cuts for top earners enacted at the beginning of the decade expire in 2011. That would raise the top rate from 35% to 39.6% on incomes above $373,000. During the presidential campaign, Obama favored bolstering Social Security by subjecting the family income above $250,000 to the 12.4% payroll tax, paid equally by employees and employers. Tax currently is levied on income up to $102,000. All told, shifting the cost of health care, Social Security, and other budget priorities toward high-income Americans would mean an actual tax rate above 45% for the wealthiest. Levels never seen, says Clint Stretch, a tax expert at Deloitte Tax LLP. When top rates were higher, tax shelters helped reduce the percentage of income paid. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said this week that Obama believes that the richest 1% of this country has had a pretty good run of it for many, many, many years. The top 1% had income of $557,000 or more, according to the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center. Richard Wolff continues, relying on top earners to pay for benefit programs risk reversal if Republicans return to power, says William Gale of the Brookings Institution, a think tank. We cannot do this on the backs of the rich, he says. Robert McIntyre, the Liberal Citizens for Tax Justice, says Obama eventually must look beyond these 6.4 million taxpayers earning $200,000 or more. At some point, you just can't squeeze them anymore, he says. So that was Richard Wolff out of USA Today. Robert Samuelson, Washington Post. The deeper source of our predicament is a self-indulgent political culture that avoids a rigorous discussion of government's role. Everyone favors benefits and opposes burdens or taxes. Republicans want to cut taxes without cutting spending. Democrats want to increase spending without increasing taxes, except on the rich. The differences between the parties are shades of gray. Hardly anyone asks the hard question of who doesn't need benefits, which programs are expendable, and what taxes might cover remaining deficits. Obama would make matters worse. He talks about controlling entitlement spending, mainly Social Security and Medicare, but hasn't done so. He's proposing just the opposite. His health care proposal would increase federal spending. He says he will pay for the added outlays with tax increases or other spending cuts, but what people forget is that every penny of this payment could be used and should be to close the long-term deficit, not raise future spending and taxes. That was Robert Samuelson. Ben Stein, New York Times. By many metrics, the economy has stopped falling drastically, but we are still in a painful recession, large by post-war standards. The bank crises seem to have abated for now, and Wall Street is paying itself fantastically well again, thank heavens, after being rescued with taxpayer money. But housing is still extremely weak, profits are miserable, and most important, far too many Americans are unemployed, roughly 9.5% by the latest data. Just as basic, far too many Americans are living in fear. What is President Obama doing about it? Perhaps too much, and possibly his efforts are too diffuse. When I think about the economy, I think about a plump man who has just been hit by a truck while crossing a street and is in severely critical condition with internal bleeding. Instead of just stabilizing his hemorrhaging, the doctor decides that while the patient is unconscious, he might as well also do a facelift, some coronary bypasses, and a stomach stapling to keep him from gaining weight while he is recovering, if he does recover. After all, a crisis is not to be wasted. The problem is that all these ambitious operations create too much of a burden for the human body to bear. Similarly, we have an administration that is simultaneously seeking to end the recession, discussing drastic changes to laws on filler closures and energy use and completely changing the healthcare system. I respectfully question all of this makes sense. That was Ben Stein. And now me, where you could say it's all financial suicide. The top tax rate in New York City could run as high as 59%, according to Washington-based Tax Foundation. And as the New York Post reported, the $544 billion tax hike proposed by House Democrats would violate one of President Obama's ironclad campaign promises. No family will pay higher tax rates than they would have paid in the 1990s. And, the Post notes, the legislation is especially onerous for business owners in part because it penalizes employers with a payroll bigger than $400,000, some 8% of wages, if they don't offer health care. So President Obama told us he was going to work quickly. None of the wait 24 hours attitude I like to employ. No thinking things through before acting. He's like the Indians of the American West who would stampede buffalo over a cliff, everyone following the leader. And when it's over, he'll walk over to the edge with Rahm Emanuel and Nancy Pelosi, survey the carnage down below, bodies piled one on top of the other, shrug his shoulders and go, "Huh, guess that didn't work. Listen, Sasha's got a ball game I'm knocking off for a while." I feel as if I've been very patient with the Obama presidency thus far. I wanted to see how things would play out, where he'd deviate, as he has in some aspects of foreign policy, like the aggressive stances on Afghanistan and Pakistan. But I think we're all in agreement that aside from issues of national security and thwarting terrorism, there is nothing more important than ending the financial crisis and getting people back to work, period. Everything else can wait. So for crying out loud, Mr. President, would you slow down? It's not even a matter of being ideologically pure and thinking you'll soak the rich to pay for all your social programs. It's plain recklessness. And as Ben Stein notes above, little of it makes any sense, including, critically, the health plan that the director of the Congressional Budget Office told a Senate committee significantly expands the federal responsibility for health care cost. Long-term savings? Are you kidding me? Of course, the whole point of tackling entitlements was to get control of our long-term liabilities, not increase them further. But all of us are going to have to take some responsibility ourselves. The USA Today Gallup survey revealed the following. By 56-33, we want major changes to the healthcare system this year. 6 in 10 favor the idea of requiring employers to provide health insurance. But 9 in 10 oppose limits on getting whatever tests or treatments they want. As with everything else in our society, we want it all, until we're suddenly unemployed, or find ourselves working for half the pay we used to, and or with a new employer who either doesn't offer health care or makes the employees pay far more than they were used to. Then we scream about it, and it all just cracks me up. But now it's about far more than just health care and the Democrats' plans to sock not just fat cat Wall Streeters, whom I have little sympathy for myself, but the two-income family of, say, engineers bringing home $250,000 combined but living in a high-cost part of the country. They aren't rich. No difference, says our president. I wonder what the makeup of the typical Obama rally will be in 1 year if he has his way on taxes. You just know that half the people, at least, in his audiences today are thinking to themselves, "Hey, what he just said applies to me. I'm not wealthy, but I'm about to get whacked. Oh well, don't want to look bad, I'll clap." I'm thinking a year from now he could be talking in front of a crowd of street bums with surly throngs outside. Now, admittedly, the preceding is a bit of a worst-case scenario taken to the extreme, but there is real cause for concern these days, and many of us now placing our fates in the hands of the U.S. Senate, where it's hoped cooler heads will prevail enough to rein in our leader and his worst intentions. As of Friday afternoon, they were indeed doing so. Meanwhile, after a four-week slide, stocks soared on the heels of solid, though hardly spectacular, earnings from some big players, including Intel, IBM, and investment banks J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs. At the start of the week, it jotted down 9 key names, the first four plus Johnson & Johnson, Google, GE, Bank of America, and Citigroup, and they all beat. Wall Street took the data and ran with it, as the S&P 500 and NASDAQ soared 7%, the best week since coming off the March 9 lows. It didn't matter that some, such as IBM, said business spending really wasn't picking up, or that Google's revenue growth was only 3%, or that no one really knows what bombs still lie beneath the surface at GE Capital, or that JP Morgan and Bank of America reiterated that while there might be a little lessening of future credit losses, we do still have a huge problem on our hands, particularly in commercial lending. Nor does it seem to matter that these states continue to hemorrhage, with first quarter tax revenues coming in down 11.7%, or that a leading lender to small and mid-sized businesses, CIT, is struggling for its life as I do this podcast and did not receive a federal bailout, which was an actual positive. Nope, the week was a perfect example of why I've been saying all year that while I'm as troubled as the next guy about the fundamentals in the economy, over the course of 2009, sentiment will trump lousy data and will finish solidly positive. This week will look better than the previous four, for instance, but we have a long, long way to go before we can put 09 in the books, including a ton of items on the geopolitical front to deal with in the interim. One item that did help Wall Street and was totally legitimate, as much as you want to believe the numbers, was the release of China's second quarter GDP figure, up 7.9%, as its stimulus program has taken hold in a big way. In the month of June, we also learned that industrial production rose 10.7% and retail sales 15% there. But the Beijing government is leery that the momentum can be continued, while recognizing that instead of the historic focus on export-led growth, it needs to turn inward and generate a consumption economy. Staying on the global theme, while it didn't carry the weight China's data did, it was encouraging to see Singapore suddenly rebound with a Q2 GDP that was up 20% over the prior quarter. And Japan's central bank also weighed in, saying that while that nation remains solidly in recession, it reiterated the worst is over. On the flip side, Russia's GDP for the first half of the year was down a whopping 10%. Britain's unemployment rate hit 7.6%. Canada's rose to 8.6%, and Ireland's a staggering 11.7%, headed to 15%. Ireland's GDP is projected to decline 8.3% this year and another 3% in 2010. Finally, on a more potentially critical issue for this coming fall and winter, that being H1N1. This week, the World Health Organization said the, quote, 2009 influenza pandemic has spread internationally with unprecedented speed. In past pandemics, influenza viruses have needed more than 6 months to spread as widely as the new H1N1 virus has spread in less than 6 weeks. The WHO thus says the pandemic is now deemed unstoppable. Yet, we all know that for now the flu is not nearly as lethal as past variants, but it's always been about the second wave and whether or not the virus mutates. Another thing, though, that I've been focusing on is the world's preparedness, or lack thereof, and here there isn't one good thing you can say, not one. Picture that British health experts say they could see 65,000 deaths by year end. And halfway around the globe, the Aussies saw a surge of 778 cases in just 24 hours. But when I was in Calgary, Canada last week, I read some troubling stories in the newspapers concerning that country's lack of preparedness, including a severe shortage of both respiratory specialists as well as critical care nurses. In addition, as H1N1 strikes the lungs, there is a shortage around the world of a key instrument, respirators or ventilators. How do I know this? Every story I see on the topic at some point talks of a system being potentially overwhelmed from top to bottom. Personally, I'm trying to figure out a pure way, to play the ventilator angle in the stock market, being convinced you'll see a ton of press on this in the not-too-distant future. So I reiterate, we expect our health officials from the national level on down to be doing the work behind the scenes to prepare for a second wave that could explode in our faces. And while meetings are being held all over, addressing the same issues, there is zero reason to be reassured even on the vaccine front for now. Regarding the latter, imagine the hoarding that will take place. A long time ago when swine flu first hit the wires, I mused how I wouldn't want to be living in a third world country trying to deal with this. Now picture the scramble for essential care, for respirators, if H1N1 blew up in your community. Talk about rich versus poor, America will become bribe nation to be continued. I'll be back with you next Saturday, July 25th. Have a great week.